Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 59, section 3, which is old single column, page 676. Okay, so we are... if you recall from last session, we are stepping through the periods, they're called, of you know, as you can see from the top of the, you know, from the title of the paper here, the marine life era, or, you know, in terms of historical geology, the Paleozoic era. All right, those eras. Now, if you can't remember, you can flip back to the beginning of paper 59 there, and just remind yourself of how, you know, they gave you those eras: the Archaeozoic, the Proterozoic, the Paleozoic, the Mesozoic, the Cenozoic. All right, and we zeroed in on the marine life era, the Paleozoic. Now that early life, and we're just one section at a time now. They're stepping you through, you know, eras are divided into what are called periods. And so we did the first two, the Cambrian, you know, they're in section one. And then we went to the Ordovician in section two. And now we're ready for the Silurian. If you can't remember in the midst of one of these sections, what period you're in, you can always flip to the end of these sections. You know, so like if you flip to this one, you see right at the very end of the section, you know, it says it's the Silurian. So that's the kind of key for, you know, if you have a reminder. And remember how I pointed out, just as an aside, in terms of the literalness of these period names, these first ones are tied to whales. Cambria, it's just an old name for whales. And then, the words Ordovician and Silurian are two tribes in Wales. Yes, two different ancient tribes in Wales. All right, so it's just a reminder, you know, of where a lot of this understanding got started, you know, in terms of sorting out, these divisions of the whole stratigraphic column.
Then it switches to the French in the next one.
No.
The frogs, right?
I'm sorry. Yeah, but I'll tell you about that one when we get to it. A lot of that early work was happening there in the British Isles. The other thing, if you flip back and just remind yourself of the titles, you know, so that first one, first section was early marine life in the shallow seas, the trilobite age. You know, so we started out, we had the trilobites being the very dominant phenomenon. And then you see this section two, the first continental flood stage, the invertebrate animal age. Remember how we closed out about the Ordovician? We basically had the full spectrum of the invertebrates in play, and they were, you know, going forward with great vigor and diversifying and spreading into every nook and cranny on the planet that they could get to. So you can see the title of this one, as we move into the Silurian. Those brachiopods are still definitely a fundamental life form. But as you see as we get into it, those big brains of those feet with heads, you know, cephalopods, right? Feet with a foot with a head. That obviously is going to begin to manifest itself as a dominance, you know, to have that much brain power, not to mention to be mobile, right, you know, against those animals that are fixed to the ocean floor or whatever. And so, you know, you're definitely going to have a transition towards the cephalopods. And the other thing that we saw, you know, in those previous ones, previous periods that we see here again, is just over and over and over again, just endless cycles of everything's underwater. Okay, now everything's above water. Everything's underwater again. Now everything's above water. I mean, it's all very shallow, you know, in terms of the continents. You know, there isn't a lot of extremely high regions, so it doesn't take much flexing, you know, in this continental drift mode, this more plastic-like crust mode, for it to undulate and, you know, go down and above and down and above and, you know, in very horizontally vast scale. I mean, there are fingers and whatnot too, but you know, you can just about everything at some point, you know, is, you know, gets underwater one way or another. So there's lots and lots of marine sediments, you know, sediments that are deposited, you know, down at the bottom of the water, you know, whether it's shallow or deep, you know, down to the floor of this, on the seafloor. That we really are going to stay in that mode. You'll see that. And as we read through this, again, it's, you know, it's pretty straightforward. I'm not going to be delving, you know, any more deeply necessarily into the direct science of it. But I'll just stress again, you know, just think about how each time they tell you some scientific fact in a definitive fashion, you know, they're trying to give the scientists firm anchor points for their picture. You know, and even if, you know, a particular item might be basically believed today, you know, if you dug deep into it, you might find, maybe even forgotten by modern geologists, that there was a time when that was a little bit fuzzy, and it sort of just, they kind of just forgot about the question mark as the decades rolled on, and now it's treated like it's definitive. You know, the revelators, you know, if they state it definitively, that's, you know, that's giving you a rock solid anchor point that you can construct a picture on, you know, and not have to always wonder, it's like, well, maybe there's a question mark next to that, and maybe I'm building upon sand here if I really try to go forward with that. You know, so it's that kind of assistance. I mean, and that's true in general. I mean, just think in the same way, and they're telling you stuff about your initial relationship to spirit substance, you know, and your efforts to develop a genuine religious consciousness, a genuine religious life. Humans have been all over the map on rationalization schemes about various experiences. And, you know, the revelators go, you know, touch upon all those things, sometimes actively dismissing something. Sometimes you can notice between the lines, huh, they didn't even mention that, you know, so it's like a passive dismissal. You know, other times giving you something that you never imagined, you know, is the anchor point to try to build an objective understanding of your experiences around. Okay. So it's just, you know, it's just as true when you're trying to get a definitive relationship to the spirit substance in the external world as it is to a definitive relationship to the material substance in the external world. You know, to use the revelation as that authoritative elimination of error. No matter how much what they're saying you know, might seem to not agree with appearance, whether it's the appearance in the fossil record or the appearance, you know, in the deepest recesses of your mind, you know, in your most cherished spiritual experiences, right? You know, they're not there to affirm appearances. They're there, and the revelators are trying to give you the reality behind the appearance. So definitely when you go, you know, when a paleontologist is looking at some of the things in here, they'll go, well, no, I mean, that's not the what. I mean, do they not know the fossil record? You know, there's not the slightest appearance of that being the case. Yes, that's the whole point, right? You know, that often reality is not what it appears to be, right? And that's the point of a revelation, to give you that which you can't figure out yourself.
Chris, when does the 1.4 start to go to closer to 1?
Oh, a good point. Yeah. Yeah. So literally, yeah, I'm glancing down at my sheet here. As we go from the beginning of the Ordovician, it was still 1.4, but the beginning of the Silurian, it's 1.5 roughly, and it's going to stay that way for the next one too. Yeah, there's a little bit of an upslope, just a tiny bit, you know, and then it goes down to one. And one can wonder if that little bit of an upslope from 1.4 to 1.6 before it goes down is real, or if it's just an artifact of how imprecise my initial efforts anyway at trying to figure out that ratio is. You know, you don't have a lot of significant digits in your Rancho book, okay, so that's an issue, you know, and then you've got all kinds of issues with...
it's based on atomic dating, though, right? Or, I mean, that's what you're talking
about. Right, I mean, you've got those radiometric dates, right, and they have issues, you know, you got to try to take that into account. I mean, you know, you can get a lot of people come up with a lot, you know, slightly different numbers for a given supposed, you know, like beginning of the Silurian.
Right, because that fact alone, just that we were just talking about this, that's, you know, I have some friends who pretty much, you know, really got into the religious part of the Ranch book, but just say, well, there's so many facts in here that are so far off. And, you know, as you say, it's hard for them to really look for the truth here, but, and this is one of them.
Right, see, and like we pointed out, I mean, you know, saying that it's off by a factor of 1.5, okay, that, you know, there's no scientist that thinks that's a possibility. They know that there's possible, you know, they could be off by a little bit, but not by that much, right? But see, that's the whole point. I mean, that's why they can give us these dates, right? I mean, if we could have gotten the correct dates radiometrically, they wouldn't have put dates in the book here. They couldn't have. That would have been a violation of the mandate. You know, because we hadn't figured out those dates way back when they gave us the book, right? So
we don't know
that's the whole point.
Radioactivity had a different rate of decay
different rate.
In those days than it does today.
Right. And there's no way.
I thought it's the same all the time.
Right. We just, I mean, for a scientist to assume anything else would, you know, would be inappropriate. I mean, to just randomly say that, you know, it was different. I mean, you know, based upon what? They have nothing to base that on. You know, it's only appropriate for them to assume it's constant going back in time. Yeah, so, but that assumption breaks down before he go back very far. And it's off by about a factor of 1.5 here as we're reading this. Okay, well, I think enough said up front. Let's read a little bit here.
The second great flood stage, the coral period, the brachiopod age. 300 million years ago, another great period of land submergence began. The southward and northward encroachment of the ancient Silurian seas made ready to engulf most of Europe and North America. The land was not elevated far above the sea so that not much deposition occurred about the shorelines. The seas teemed with lime-shelled life, and the falling of these shells to the sea bottom gradually built up very thick layers of limestone. This is the first widespread limestone deposit, and it covers practically all of Europe and North America, but only appears at the Earth's surface in a few places. The thickness of this ancient rock layer averages about 1,000 feet, but many of these deposits have since been greatly deformed by tilting, upheavals, and faulting, and many have been changed to quartz, shale, and marble.
Now, right there at the end, you probably already caught that. See, there's a typo. Okay, you know, that's obviously supposed to be quartz slate, in marble. Remember, we went through all that, you know, just before. You know, that's a typo. Someone, you know, goofed and didn't catch it there. You know, remember, let's see, where was that? Just, you know, see, in the block for 370 million years ago, the second paragraph in that one, you know, it said sandstone had been turned into quartz. Shale has been changed into to slate, while limestone has been converted into marble. Right? Yeah, so that's a little typo that somehow got in there. But you notice again that, like I said before, it just says quartz, you know. And if you're a geologic fanatic, you know, don't start screaming. It's like, no, it's supposed to be quartzite. Yeah, remember we talked about that. It's, you know, that's fine to just use the kind of common parlance, you know, especially way back then. But so technically, yes, okay, quartzite. It's quartz rock, not just quartz minerals, and slate and marble. Just notice that. Towards the beginning of that paragraph, they remind you of what I was just saying up front. The land was not elevated far above the sea, so that not much deposition occurred about the shorelines. Okay, far elevated. Yeah, that's why it can go above and below so easily. But, you know, see, think about it logically, too, that other little step. I mean, you know, if you don't have great big highlands, you know, eroding over millions of years, you know, you're not going to get huge depositions of stuff down, you know, around the coasts. Right. So you got to keep that in mind in terms of, you know, what, if you find deposits that are, you know, very much coming from continental erosion, you know, that's also indicating there must be from some pretty significant highlands, you know, at that time. Or at least in that area, right? Yeah. So, you know, I throw in little things like that, like I said, just so those of you who aren't geologists, and that's everyone in the room, obviously, but, you know, but you still can, you know, work on thinking precisely about material facts and bringing in a simple logical, you know, correlation like that, you know. You know, fostering that development of your your scientific consciousness, so that, you know, if you do, like I said up front, improve the focus of your religious consciousness, the two can come together in a super additive consequence, right? And you can begin to relate to truth. Right. Well, with just one or the other, you don't have the super additive consequence. You don't have the subsequent wholeness, you know, and it's only in that wholeness that there's truth. Right. And yeah, and again, if this is a revelation of truth, you would like to eventually get at the truth. Right. But it's not in any of the words that, you know, are in front of you. Truth cannot be defined with words. Right, so it's part of the process to begin to get at, you know, even the religious truths in the revelation can only be had like this, by having a basic scientific consciousness. You don't have to be all analytic and everything. You don't have to bring in mathematics or anything, right? Just a basic scientific consciousness, be able to use your logical acumen and sort things out precisely, bring that together with your religious consciousness. Okay, let's see. You know, just notice at the end there, you know, we're talking about stuff that's way, way back, and everything is, you know, flexing about and whatnot. So, you know, you go forward to today and look at this stuff, and a lot of it's going to be greatly deformed. Yeah, it's just inescapable if it's been laid down way, way, way back. You know, it's gone through a lot of troublous times, right, to get to today.
What's amazing are the places that aren't deformed.
Yeah.
There are lots of places where the layers are just...
dead flat, yeah, over vast, you know, areas, and, yeah, yep. Yeah, so you know that that location, if it's a really old bed, you know, has been very, very stable. It's one of these places that, you know, kind of is missed. And when they talk about all this stuff flexing and what, you know, it's one of those quiet areas. You know, there are those places. Yeah. Okay.
No fire rocks or lava are found in the stone layers of this period, except those of the great volcanoes of southern Europe and eastern Maine and the lava flows of Quebec. Volcanic action was largely past. This was the height of great water deposition. There was little or no mountain building.
Just that initial term of fire rocks, you know, might catch you as kind of curious, you know, speak of it like that. You know, you can even think all the way back in ancient Greek terms, you know, with the four elements, earth, water, fire, and air. And, you know, we're talking about water rocks a lot, see, you know, in contrast, saying fire rocks. Obviously, they mean volcanic rocks, right? But, you know, they picked up on some of these things, you know, that are in those human texts that they're using as a rough template, you know, and wanting to play it. You know, they don't want it to come off as, you know, this like a scientific textbook. You know, they want to, you know, say it in a way that's, you know, that's not an offense to the geologists that, you know, were writing about it. You know, definitely those geologists talked about it, you know, and, you know, this is the stuff that's been subject to fire, quote unquote, you know, the fiery bowels of the earth, or, you know, saying statements like that. But it makes it more approachable for the, you know, the general reader. You know, they, even if they're doing something really specific for a human source work, I mean, they don't go to some advanced, scholarly article in some, you know, advanced refereed journal or something. They'll try to find something that was a little bit more tailored, you know, for the common man to play off of. Okay, so in other words, you know, we don't have a lot of, you know, you won't have a lot of rocks that you can date, you know, interspersed with your sedimentary rocks, you know, in a lot of areas. You know, that, remember we talked about how that's the between the lines of that, you know, them telling you that. You know, so you're going to have to, it's like, well, there's something, I know how, you know, how old this one above is, and I know how old this one below is, and this has got to be somewhere in between. Let's see. You know, we definitely know that really intense volcanic action, you know, way back like that volcanic age that we read, you know, way, way, way back, you know, that's way in the rearview mirror. We don't have super cataclysmic stuff happening, right? You can have some pretty significant volcanic outbreaks occasionally in various places. You know, it's just much, you know, it's going to be much more of a regional cataclysm and not, you know, kind of a planet scale sort of cataclysm anymore. Yeah.
When they're talking about water deposition, mm-hmm. if there's not a lot of erosion going on in the land, what's the water depositing?
Well, I mean, we got all kinds of life. I mean, you may just have shells piling up and getting huge beds of limestone. Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. And then again, that last little bit, remember, you know, precisely, there's definitely not quote unquote mountain building because we're a long ways away from plate tectonics yet. But occasionally, you know, remember they, you know, if it's a significantly high ridge, you know, they'll refer to it as a mountain and not be pedantic about it, right? But they are pointing out, you know, you aren't getting a lot of huge flexing necessarily in most places either. It's pretty flat and calm, okay?
What's the chemical composition of limestone, doesn't it?
Calcium carbonate.
Pardon?
Calcium carbonate.
So there's large amounts of carbon being sequestered
right.
in the limestone.
Yep, right. I mean, you always have that going on. You know, besides plants taking up carbon dioxide, you know, you've got stuff getting, you know, turned into rock. You've got it sequestered in rock as well. Yep. All right. You know, remember how we were stepping along 10 million years at a time here, so.
290 million years ago, the sea had largely withdrawn from the continents, and the bottoms of the surrounding oceans were sinking. The land masses were little changed until they were again submerged. The early mountain movements of all the continents were beginning, and the greatest of these crustal upheavals were the Himalayas of Asia and the great Caledonian Mountains, extending from Ireland through Scotland and on to Spitsbergen.
Okay, so just, you know, at the beginning there, notice how they're reminding you. It's definitely still in that mode where a lot of what's happening is if a continent goes up, the, you know, seafloor is going down. It's just this, you know, reciprocal phenomenon. Yeah, but I wanted to point out, see, they notice how you're getting the sense about the way they say that, that the crust is starting to get a little bit harder, and it's not all the way to full-on kind of modern, you know, state, current state. But you can see by the way they're saying that, it is getting harder, okay? And that's going to be slowly, you know, gradually, you know, occurring. It's not like it's plastic and then one day it just, you know, gets all solid and goes to plate tectonics. But so that's what's between the lines there, is that we have the crust continuing to get more and more rigid. And you're going to, you know, and you're starting to see some of the early signs of what ends up, you know, being part of, you know, some of the morphology of the planet that we know today. And, you know, one of the things that might strike you there is, you know, the Caledonian Mountains, in other words, you know, the Scottish Mountains, again, you know, just the old name for Scotland, you know, going, you know, do you know where Spitsbergen is?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you know, north of the, you know, the northernmost part of mainland Norway, you know, up there just east of, you know, northern Greenland. Okay, so if you think going from the top of the British Isles there with Ireland and Scotland, you know, and across all that, you know, ocean all the way up to Spitsbergen, see if having all that being above water, you know, not having ocean there, and a whole big mountain range kind of back then.
So this was a period of time in which the part of Scotland that's above the Great Glen had already broken off from Newfoundland and come across the ocean?
Well, see, again, you don't want to think anything like that. I mean, we were back in a mode where, you know, it hasn't broken up into plates and all that sort of stuff. It's just not like it is right now.
I see. So it's somewhere.
You know, when they say Ireland and Scotland, they're saying the part of the continents, you know, that, you know, eventually end up being what we call, you know, Ireland and Scotland today. Mm-hmm. Right? But, you know, having, you know, it's kind of reminding you, you know, why do you have that stuff sticking out of the ocean up there, you know, in the Arctic, like that still today, you know, Spitsbergen and the other islands around it? It's because it goes way back. See, that's what I was trying to get you. They're trying to point out that some of the, you know, of the geography that we have today began to kind of have its early foundational forms set up way back here. Right? You know, many, many, you know, tens of millions of years before any sort of a more current phenomena, you know, sort of built upon that beginning. Right? You have a basic truth to the system, is maybe a way to think about it, see? And it's not surprisingly that in that kind of overarching truth of the geology of the planet, different you know, passing temporal phenomena express within that truth. Okay? We've been seeing that from the beginning. I mean, by, you know, right away, long before we have the current continents, right? They're talking about this land and that. In the form of, you know, this is, you know, Africa and this is Asia, right? I mean, it's not literally Africa in fact, but it is in truth Africa, right? It's that aspect of the earth that eventually becomes the Africa that we know today, right? Through all kinds of variations, and yet, right, a red thread of constancy, right? Of, uniformitarianism, you know, like, you know, to bring in that term again. I see some, you know, why can you, you know, why can an ism like uniformitarianism have any validity? Right? You know, the earth isn't literally, precisely, factually, you know, exactly the same process as way back when as it is now. But there's a truth to that, right? You know, the farther you go back, you may have to kind of penetrate deeper and deeper to the core of the whole phenomenon and ignore, you know, the more, you know, extended elements of what's going on, you know, from that core, extended from the core. But there's a basic truth to the earth that is playing out over time. Okay, I think I got everything. It was just a short little guy. Let's see. It was kind of fun. The land masses were little changed until they were again submerged. See, again, just reminding you of, I mean, it goes up and nothing, you know, really changes that much, and it goes back down again because there isn't really much potential for it to change. It's not like great big huge mountains and they get eroded totally down before it goes down again or anything like that.
Kind of like the whole surface is in this kind of plastic undulation. It's just
kind of yeah.
slowly rolling around the
mm-hmm.
surface and forming.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and again, that's why some of these beds can be so flat, because they're, you know, in some areas there just isn't any way that they can not be that unflat, right? Yep, okay.
It is in the deposits of this age that much of the gas, oil, zinc, and lead are found. The gas and oil being derived from the enormous collections of vegetable and animal matter carried down at the time of the previous land submergence, while the mineral deposits represent the sedimentation of sluggish bodies of water. Many of the rock salt deposits belong to this period.
I see. You know, starting to get, you know, you'll get these pockets where, you know, it's just, there's seawater in there, and then it gets closed off, and it all dries up, and there's nothing but salt left, you know, and then it gets open again, there's more, then it gets closed off again, and all that seawater evaporates, and just, you know, salt will build up in some areas, you know, the massive depths. And you can see now, you know, once we really got life much more exploded, as it were, you know, over vast regions, you know, like think about a lot of the continent having lots of vegetation on it. Then the whole thing goes underwater, right? And it all dies off. And you can start to build up a lot of you know, gas and oil deposits.
Yeah, right.
Okay. You know, until you had enough organic matter to, you know, really amount to something, you're not going to find significant, extensive, you know, sequestered carbon.
Meaning this is a good place to look for gas and oil?
Right. I mean, we find lots of gas and oil, you know, down in here. Yes. You know, don't worry, the geologists all know about that. There's lots of wells. Yes, but see, that's the thing. I mean, like I said, you notice how I'm stressing. I'm trying to just, you know, get you to think about, you know, the whole logical process of, you know, why, you know, don't just, you know, look for where, like where is oil, you know, is the oil, right? Think about that question, why is there oil? That's what, you know, this is a philosophic text. Think about why questions. See if you can get yourself to have that logical relationship with your surroundings. The why of oil, the why of zinc deposits, you know, or whatever. Okay.
The trilobites rapidly declined. And the center of the stage was occupied by the larger mollusks, or cephalopods. These animals grew to be 15 feet long and 1 foot in diameter and became masters of the seas. This species of animal appeared suddenly and assumed dominance of sea life.
You remember, they didn't state that explicitly back there in the Ordovician when we started to have cephalopods. But, you know, but obviously, things like that, just suddenly there was cephalopods. Right, with no transition forms.
15 foot long.
And of course, well, remember that, you know, we've got, you know, that's the giant, like giant squid today. I mean, that's the size of, you know, giant squid today. You know, not counting those, you know, those long tentacles like that a giant squid has, but, you know, their basic body and legs, right?
Yeah.
All right, so they're just pointing out that you had those really big ones very early on, and they continue right on to today. We'll see that a lot. As we mentioned with lots of these different creatures, they come out of nowhere, right, and are there in sort of full flower and just stay that way, basically unchanged, right? They're a plateau phenomenon. They aren't just a means to a greater end. They're part of the basic ongoing scaffolding of the whole life system on the planet, and all the adjutants are grounded in ongoing fashion on those stable plateaus of life. That basically come into their fully evolved nature in relatively short fashion and just stay that way then for ages and ages after that. So like I said, see, even though it says, the brachiopod age, you got lots and lots of brachiopods, you definitely have the cephalopods, beginning to move into obvious dominance here. The trilobites are fading away. Let's see, anything else there? I've got everything there. Yeah, keep going.
The great volcanic activity of this age was in the European sector. Not in millions upon millions of years had such violent and extensive volcanic eruptions occurred as now took place around the Mediterranean trough and especially in the neighborhood of the British Isles. This lava flow over the British Isles region today appears as alternate layers of lava and rock 25,000 feet thick. These rocks were laid down by the intermittent lava flows, which spread out over a shallow seabed, thus interspersing the rock deposits, and all of this was subsequently elevated high above the sea. Violent earthquakes took place in northern Europe, notably in Scotland.
Right, so in other words, they're just reminding you, those northern regions, you got things fractured up really severely way back then, and that fractured nature goes forward in time to today. You can see just exactly like I said. I mean, you don't have any sort of like global volcanic phenomenon, but you can have a region, a pretty big region, that just gets very violent for a span of time, and would be, if there had been land animals, it would have been very difficult for them in those regions. But we don't have any land animals yet, so it just would have been plants and some sea creatures maybe having some issues and stuff, like they're pointing out. See, a lot of this is getting deposited in the water.
25,000 feet thick.
And again, just, if you're not, used to thinking about how thick the geology, this sedimentary geology of the Earth is, it's lots and lots of thousands of feet, right? Stuff gets piled up, we're stepping along in tens of millions of years, remember? Yeah. 10 million years. A lot of dirt can pile up in 10 million years, right? A lot of mud can settle to the bottom of a shallow sea in 10 million years,
yeah.
Right? You know how much dust can build up in your house in just a week, right?
Do the math.
Do the math, right? It piles up. Countless numbers of sea creatures living and dying, not to mention all of the, all the plant life living and dying, and just, building up and building up and building up. Okay, let's see, did we get everything there? You can obviously notice, again, they're pointing to those, like I said, these early foundational points for understanding this in the British Isles areas. You can see that's why that keeps getting brought up here.
There's a place on the northern part of the Isle of Skye, mm-hmm. which is off the west coast of Scotland. They call it today the Querangs, and it's the weirdest landform. It's been used in a lot of movies.
Mm-hmm.
Game of Thrones is filmed there, and a lot of these prehistoric movies will film up there because it's a very, very singular landscape, largely because it looks broken.
Yeah.
There'll be a massive mountain, and then this conk, and then the other part of it is laying down there. It's really a strange thing.
Notably in Scotland, yeah. I see violent earthquakes. See, like I was saying, you know, see, so, you know, that, you know, I they don't mention that because, well, you know, way back there was these violent earthquakes and things got really messed up, and, you know, but you'd never know that. And now, you know, I mean, you know, a lot of that stuff you can definitely tell. At some point, there was really violent earthquakes here, obviously. Things got really busted up.
The oceanic climate remained mild and uniform, and the warm seas bathed the shores of the polar lands. Brachiopod and other marine life fossils may be found in these deposits right up to the North Pole. Gastropods, brachiopods, sponges, and the reef-making corals continued to increase.
Okay, so we are, it got going in the previous period in the Ordovician. You know, so they're just reminding all these things that got started are still definitely on the increase. Things are plowing forward, and getting more and more diverse and more areas. And it can really go everywhere, like they're saying, because really no hint of continental climate coming in yet. Staying very, very definitively an oceanic, you know, or a marine climate. You know, the warm seas bathe the shores of the polar lands. So that, you know, that's a tricky thing to kind of keep in mind, just how, architectural sphere-like it was way back then. The temperature was basically the same all over the globe. And it's like, oh, there seemed to have been a fall. It's not like that anymore. Now you have all these uninhabitable places. They're, you know, very cold and all that. So you can kind of think between the lines. Remember how they were hinting at, paradise there, you know, the Garden of Eden and, you know, and things like that. That stuff is the revelators definitely appreciate that between the lines when they're writing this and are wanting you to kind of think about that. It's like, well, okay, there really wasn't that sort of fall, you know, from an idyllic state. But there's kind of a truth to it, yeah, especially if you go way back in time. There was a time when it was very mild all over the planet, and then it got harsher. And that's not a coincidence, because there's nothing more devastating to humans making progress than salubrious climes, right? You need cattle prods. And coincidentally, the planet became filled with cattle prods, right? And the salubrious clime went away. You were pushed out of the Garden of Eden, right? And had to figure out how to make clothes and, you know, things like that. Shelters, snow blowers. Right, whatnot. So that's
move to Maui.
That's another thing that sees us between the lines. Yeah, again, just challenge yourself to think, what's the truth that's flowing through these paragraphs? It's not just, you know, facts, right? That's not the point. They're not revealing facts, they're revealing truth. Try to get in that mode when you're reading it like this. Okay?
The close of this epoch witnesses the second advance of the Silurian seas with another commingling of the waters of the southern and northern oceans. The cephalopods dominate marine life, while associated forms of life progressively develop and differentiate.
I already kind of jumped the gun on that, so you just, you know, reminding of how it, once you've got something through vertical evolution, you know, then it just fans out in horizontal evolution, differentiates into all sorts of different, you know, specific forms. And the same thing, like I said, I told you you'd see, it's like you have these inundations, you know, over and over and over again. You do notice that they, they occasionally bring in kind of these big picture things like commingling of the waters of the southern and northern oceans. As you'll see as you go forward, you know, sometimes that has a big, big consequence. When we look back in the fossil record, we can see occasionally that, you know, something is very prolific and then all of a sudden, poof, it's gone. You know, we have these mass extinctions. You know, some of that is due, you have stuff that's liking. It's got its territory all laid out here, and these other guys over here, and then the continents flex, and the two regions are brought together, and you know, and there's this great battle for dominance, and something totally disappears, and you have a lot of that sort of stuff going on, where once kind of safe niches in the, you know, the terrain or the oceans or whatnot, you know, suddenly get opened. You know, someone is given access to that, and you're not dominant anymore. You're dead. Okay, so it's a, you know, it's definitely an aggressive environment for the for life.
Right? Gradual, but aggressive.
Yeah, but you know, when you're stepping forward by 10 million years, you know. Got a lot of them, and 10 million years later, poof, you don't have any of them anymore. Right? It has to do with lots of different things, but that's one of them. It's just the fact that you know, they get all adapted to a certain region, and then everything changes on them. Right? Remind you,
if you... aside, maybe you haven't done this or not.
Yep.
But, where do you guess we'll probably be in 10 million years? How far? We think we'll be still in the local universe?
Yeah, it all depends on...
I know, it depends. You know, I wonder if you thought that if you've done that one yet.
How slow we are, you know.
And the only reason I ask is because in comparing that, you know, the time it takes for the planet to evolve, mm-hmm. the time it takes, you know, us to evolve, so to speak, is kind of a sort of an interesting thing to think of from my point of view.
Yeah. The one that always, you know, kind of seems like it's got to slow you down some is the billion worlds of Avona, right?
Well, yeah,
you know, yeah, but you know, you think about, well, you know, coming back out, you know, it's like, well, of course you can't come back out to your super universe, you know, right away, you know, you know, but
I wasn't even thinking of just even in the local universe in terms of the time. You know, that a plant takes for a planet to evolve versus...
Yeah, especially when, you know, remember, you know, a lot of us, you know, most likely won't be taking a beeline, you know, in our ascension career. It'll be also, well, you know, I'm going to take off, you know, a few million years and go do this thing off to the side for a while, you know. I mean, there's probably all kinds of things that we do horizontally, depending on... The more our personality begins to manifest and the more it's apparent, ooh, we've got someone, we really need them, you know, to serve for a couple hundred million years over here, you know, and they need to put their ascension scheme on hold for a while because, boy, we really need them over here.
But you get that experience.
Right,
and
you get all that experience.
When you finally get there, you kind of wish maybe you'd done some of
it. Yeah, so it all, yeah, as I said, there's going to be all kinds of variability to that question of how long it takes you to go up because the more you go up, the more your absolutely unique personality is in play, and there is no, right, there's no answer to that question. It's different for every individual, right? So, okay.
280 million years ago, the continents had largely emerged from the second Silurian inundation. The rock deposits of this submergence are known in North America as Niagara Limestone, because this is the stratum of rock over which Niagara Falls now flows. This layer of rock extends from the eastern mountains to the Mississippi Valley region, but not further west except to the south. Several layers extend over Canada, portions of South America, Australia, and most of Europe, the average thickness of this Niagara series being about 600 feet. Immediately overlaying the Niagara deposit in many regions may be found a collection of conglomerate, shale, and rock salt. This is the accumulation of secondary subsidences. This salt settled in great lagoons, which were alternately opened up to the sea and then cut off so that evaporation occurred with deposition of salt along with other matter held in solution. In some regions, these rock salt beds are 70 feet thick.
And you can go down in those salt mines, you know, those cool caverns, you know, down there, salt all around you, you know, floor, ceiling, walls, pillars, everything, you know, it's pretty cool. If you ever get a chance to go into a salt mine, that's a really cool thing to do. You know, but here you can see, you know, you got a collection of conglomerate, You know, shale and rock salt. I mean, so, you know, you can have stuff, you know, pushed up and get some erosion off the land, piled up on top of that limestone. So it's not all unchanged when it gets elevated. Let's see, anything else in there? Everyone kind of knows about Niagara and that, you know, so you've got that, you know, those more solid beds that keep it from just, you know, immediately eroding down. You can have that waterfall for a long time. But we all know, I mean, you know, it slowly erodes those back. Those falls keep moving back and back and back and back and back.
Eventually
yeah. And eventually the Great Lakes will drain out. But
don't drain them first.
You know, I mean, again, I'll just stress, I mean, a lot of this, you know, is basically known, but it's not basically known to you, mm-hmm. right? You know, you, the reader, that maybe are only reading this book because you had some spiritual experiences one time and you're curious about how to interpret them and you found this curious book in the bookstore and, right? Little do you know that in order to get an objective relationship to those spiritual experiences, you need to build up some philosophy. You need to build up a philosophic mind first. And part of that is getting kind of grounded in some facts of geology and paleontology and physics and chemistry and a few things. Okay, keep going.
The climate is even and mild, and marine fossils are laid down in the Arctic regions. But by the end of this epoch, the seas are so excessively salty that little life survives.
Ah, see, another little issue cropped up, you know. What if things get, you know, very, very salty, you know, and remember how we read, you know, the life can handle some variation, but not extremes. It's, you know, way too salty or way not salty enough, right? It's deadly, right? So you can get mass extinctions, you know, from things like that.
Where'd the salt come from?
Well, I mean, it's slowly, you know, coming out of the rock and stuff, you know, and into the water.
Right. Yeah. Dissolving.
Just more and more, it's just coming out, you know, getting into solution, dissolving out of stuff. Yeah. You have all of that, all those elements that were part of the whole collection of the earth to begin with, and you know, remember how initially. You know, nothing is leached out of the rocks. It's basically the global ocean is fresh water. Okay? But slowly, minerals start to, you know, come out of the rocks and into the water.
So you know, life almost died out. Excuse me.
Oh, yeah. Didn't you have a question?
Well, I'm just wondering. They've remained salty, have they not?
Right, but I mean, they're just reminding you that, you know, the salinity, you know, fluctuates with time over the eons. Okay?
Or the, do you think it's become less salty than at this period of time?
Well, yeah, it's obviously less salty than when it would kill the life in the, you know, because remember, like we were just saying, I mean, the stuff that's living here right now is basically the same stuff that's alive today. You know, right. A lot of that marine life, it's the same stuff we have today, right? So it would be just, it would be killed by this high salinity today, too.
Salt water syrup.
Right.
Yeah.
You get no oysters.
No.
But now, if you could get a lot of salt deposited on the land and out of the ocean, that'd bring the salinity down. Right? Oh, they actually mentioned that sort of process going on. See, and you got this whole give and take. Right? Just like you were noticing, it's like, well, now the carbon is in the air. Oh, now it's down in, now it's in the limestone, and right? All these elements are, you know, being moved about in different modes. Right?
So they don't go away, they just move around.
Right, yeah, I mean, nothing's going to leave, is leaving the planet and going off, you know, into deep space or anything. It's, yeah, it's all zero-sum games, right? I mean, you have a given amount of elements that are collected gravitationally in this ball, and it's, right, it's like we think about the weather, right? If it's exceptionally warm in some place, then it's exceptionally cold in some other place. I mean, it's just it's basically a zero-sum game. Stuff is just shuffling around.
It's all about life on this planet, the seas got salty, and we all died. Wasn't that nice?
Well, again, obviously, it didn't all die, right?
No.
Or we wouldn't be here. But see, the amazing thing about all those extinctions and stuff, it's all part of the natural culling of the herd process, right? There's a survival of the fittest thing going on. And eventually, right, you get it boiled down to that red thread that produces Andon and Fanta. And sometimes it goes through massive extinctions. It's like, okay, almost every species is superfluous, and they all die off for various reasons, and just a few live and go forward.
Well, we are a decimal planet. Could also be, right. You know, some celestial observer looking in and going, I don't really like that.
Right. No, the life carriers are in charge, and they're but to that point of a decimal world, I mean, there's going to be all the more species that go extinct on a decimal world, because there are all sorts of tangential species on a decimal world, you know, that don't go anywhere. You know, it's eventually productive. Right? So, yeah, don't be surprised if you go study another decimal world, right, that it had lots and lots of species that died off too, just like we did. You know, vastly more species have gone extinct than are alive today. Right? Yeah, I mean, that's an important thing to keep in mind as we all, you know, start to get white knuckle grips on the species that are alive today, like there's some objects of Havona, right? I mean, this is all just a very variable thing. And, you know, more have died off than are alive, right? Going extinct is not some eternal calamity, right? It's the norm, right? It, you know, not going extinct is the exception to the rule.
Yeah.
Okay? Especially on a decimal world. And that should challenge, you know, some of your worldviews.
However,
it doesn't
man
mean
didn't exist then. Man, child of God, you know, and like, I mean, so has the choice or whatever, perhaps to, you know, either prevent or delay extinction, which was not necessarily the case.
But they
choose to do that and think it's the right thing to do or whatever.
We've talked about many times, that's where you're going to need some wisdom, some philosophical perspective. You know, once you recognize, oh, species aren't necessarily eternal, so how do I decide? How much effort should I put forward to try to keep this species from going extinct? I mean, maybe I could spend, you know, an endless amount of money and it'll still go extinct because the Creative Mother Spirit's not upholding it anymore. You got to be practical, and you got to figure out, it's like, well, you know, I mean, yes, I need to be a caretaker, a steward of the earth, but I also have to keep in mind that I'm not sovereign of the external world.
But take the bald eagle, for instance.
Yeah. Yeah.
There may be other, you know, reasons why we didn't want it to go extinct because of certain kinds of values.
Right, if we use it as a symbol.
And decided to do something about it.
Right, but the, you know, but like we said, you know, the big picture is there are no carnivores in light and life. See, so, you know. Because, of course, when a world is enlightened life, it's like an architectural sphere.
Oh, wait,
right? Yeah. You know, you don't wander through the gardens of Edentia and, oops, I got eaten by a tiger. That doesn't happen in the gardens of Edentia, right?
But you could fall down and break a leg.
Yeah, you could fall down and break a leg. But, see, there's all those imponderables. How does that go? I mean, eventually there's a great taming of life. Remember one of the very first things that, you know, the princes and staff do is, you know, to try to teach people how to really get control of the animal life and become, you know, the master of the animal life rather than, you know, a helpless victim of its antecedent causation. Right? You know, so eventually all animal life is personality managed, and, you know, there's going to be a lot of change from what it is now. I mean, maybe there'll be things that are like tigers, say, but maybe they're genetically engineered.
Where's the Fandor?
So they're not carnivores anymore.
Yeah, really.
Right? See, remember, there's going to be all this genetic engineering that's going to go on. I mean, I have no idea how you go forward. It doesn't necessarily mean that they all have to die off.
Right.
Right? You know, we're going to be radically genetically engineering ourselves to get to light in life. You can't get to light without genetic engineering. Evolution and biologic uplift alone don't get worlds to light in life, like they tell you in the book. So you've got all of these imponderables, you know.
don't have beefsteak, I'm not sure I want
to. Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. It couldn't be light in life without beefsteak, right? Yeah.
to John's point about the bald eagles, you know, bald eagles weren't going extinct naturally. They were being killed by farmers.
Yeah.
And ranchers. Yeah. They were being shot, which is why their numbers were dwindling.
DDT.
Huh?
But of course,
my point wasn't the bald eagles per se. My point was more that human beings, you know, felt, from my point of view, felt that there was beauty in the bald eagle,
right. And
therefore didn't really want to see it go during my lifetime, so to speak. So there's something of different value to it than its evolutionary, sequence, so to speak.
Right. See, again, that's. So you know, there's no surer sign that personality management has come into play when you're making judgments based upon quote unquote beauty. Right? Animals don't know beauty; only humans do. And the extent to which humans are confused about the concept of beauty is the extent to which they are still struggling with their animal origin nature. Right? But I mean, just not to belabor this, but just, you know,
right.
Just the point is, so you just think about those big pictures that are always in play. You know, there's a lot of people on the planet that are completely oblivious to the fact that any species has ever gone extinct. And they treat life, you know, the species that are alive today with that initial assumption. Well, if something goes extinct, that will be the very first species in all of the history of this planet that's gone extinct.
Well, everybody knows dinosaurs went extinct, don't they? Other than they now think they got killed by a meteor hit the planet.
You'd be surprised how many people, you know, can point to the Pacific Ocean on a globe.
Or can't.
And or have the right to vote.
Okay. Or can't. Okay.
Right? All right. Yeah, you know, can't point to it. Right, yes. Yeah, so just that's my point. I mean, they're trying to educate about the basic picture so that you don't go flying off on false tangents. All right, let's see. We got to the 70 feet thick. Isn't that where we got to, or did we?
Excessively salty.
And a little light. Oh, that's right. We did, yeah, we read that little one. Yeah, that little comment there after the salt deposit, yeah. Okay. I'll just notice. Again, they keep stressing over and over. The climate is even and mild. Because you know, you might be wondering, it's like, well, are we starting to get some temperature differential? No. Okay.
Toward the close of the final Silurian submergence, there is a great increase in the echinoderms, the stone lilies, as is evidenced by the crinoid limestone deposits. The trilobites have nearly disappeared, and the mollusks continue monarchs of the seas. Coral reef formation increases greatly. During this age, in the more favorable locations, the primitive water scorpions first evolve. Soon thereafter, and suddenly, the true scorpions, actual air breathers, make their appearance. These developments terminate the third marine life period, covering 25 million years, and known to your researchers as the Silurian.
Okay, so just a couple little things there. Yeah, besides, you know, stone lilies or, you know, sea lilies, obviously related to the stone book, right? you call them stone lilies. But echinoderms, you know, starfish and sea urchins and sand dollars, you know, all those, including crinoids, like they're pointing out. And you have a lot of these, you know, limestones that are just, you know, just nothing but a big pile of crinoid parts, right? Okay, you got our mollusks, you know, especially the cephalopods, right? Obviously, are definitely the monarchs of the seas. But we see, you know, these first signs of something beginning to be astir. We've had this long bit. We have this pod and that pod. We have cephalopods and brachiopods and gastropods and whatnot. You know, we did have the trilobites, right, in terms of arthropods. But now we're going to see, arthropod stuff starting to move forward in new ways. they're hinting way ahead there of the suddenly of getting true scorpions. But long before you have them, you definitely, you know, are seeing signs of that purposing manifesting in the ocean. And just stressing again, it's always a suddenly. Right? Okay, yeah, so then there you have the Silurian.
They say the increase in CO2 in the air is causing the seas to become more acidic. Well, we're looking back at a time when the amount of CO2 in the air was
vastly
many times what
right,
it is now.
Many times what it is
so right now. You can kind of assume the sea or the water was far more acidic than it is today.
Well, you mean, yeah, but you got to take it. It's a very complex system, right? Right? I mean, the life in the seas is not identical to what it is today, right? I mean, so you got all, you know, the temperature, the ocean temperatures are very different back then than they are today. You got to, you know, it's a very, very complex system. You got to take in all those variables.
Yeah. Can
adapt. You know, we're still very much caught off guard by making certain assumptions, like, well, okay, if you turn this knob, then such and so is going to happen, you know, and that knob gets turned, and so doesn't happen, and they go, huh, you know, so they look at it more closely. Oh, there's this other process that kicked in that we didn't ever imagined, and that, you know, that modifies, you know, the what we thought was going to happen, and it's a very, very complex system, right? And so you have to always be. You know, take it with a grain of salt, pardon the pun here, talking about salt deposits, but take it with a grain of salt when you hear scientists making these definitive predictions about what the consequences are, you know, if such and so changes. It's very, very complex.
So the scorpion is actual air breathers. What's the significance of that? Is everything else, is there not really any air breathing?
Well, remember the key thing, like they mentioned way back, is, you know, we're looking for things to get to the point where you don't have so much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and you can start to have air breathers. See, so the very fact that, okay, the air right now, as they're mentioning this, as you're getting water scorpions, the air is not yet ready for air breathers. Huh, but coincidentally, it's almost like the evolutionary process knows that in the not-too-distant future, the air is going to be okay, and the precursors to that suddenly are already in place. See, that's what they're trying to get you to recognize. Right? It's almost like it knows the end from the beginning, this evolutionary process. Yes, it does, right? Right? It's nothing accidental, right? Before, you know, you need water scorpions before you get true scorpions. And, you know, and you get water scorpions not, you know, five minutes before you get, you know, true scorpions. You get them long before the air is ready for those true scorpions, but it's all in place. And just like the thing with the shells, long before there's any predators and you need a shell to protect yourself, things have shells. It's a purposed system. And that's the main thing that they're trying to get you to notice. And so you don't burrow down in the facts of, you know, what exactly is a water scorpion or something. No, you just stay back. You know, don't burrow down into the scientific facts first. See the truth that they're trying to convey. Evolution is not some random process. Right? It's, you know, it's creativity and time. It's a wholly purposed thing, right? That which is behind it has no surprises.
So soon thereafter, it could be many, many years.
God the Supreme is not surprised by anything that happens over all these hundreds of millions of years, right? The Supreme Being is at the end in the, you know, of the finite age, and the Supreme Being is fed into time as the universal mother, right? The God of evolution, right? It's inherent in the nature of that that phenomenon, that God that causes evolution and growth, right? It knows the end from the beginning, inherently, that system. It's a holistic system. It's not a bunch of parts rattling around, you know? It's a whole with parts.
So you said it knows. In this case, the Supreme Being and it?
Well, it, the evolutionary process. No, I mean, yeah, I mean, okay, yeah, I she knows, right? I mean, the universal mother. The personal, purposive God of evolution, the universal mother, knows. Okay, let's go to the next. And this is where it starts to really, big things are about to happen here. Because we move into the next period here, next geologic period.
Section 4, the great land emergence stage, the vegetative land life period, the age of fishes. In the age-long struggle between land and water, for long periods the sea has been comparatively victorious, but times of land victory are just ahead, and the continental drifts have not proceeded so far but that, at times, practically all of the land of the world is connected by slender isthmuses and narrow land bridges.
There, see, that's to help ground you in what we were just talking about a little bit ago. See, so don't think of this in the plate tectonics mode where things are these rigid plates and they've gone way far afield and all this sort of stuff. Right? It's basically just that initial single continent that's kind of oozed and flexed about and stuff. I mean, nothing has gotten too far astray yet, right? To the point where you really can kind of have it all effectively connected as one continent still, even if it literally, you know, is a blob of land with no water, you know, anywhere in the midst of it. Right? So that's the mode we're in that geologists don't imagine, because they extrapolate plate tectonics backwards, you know, to these times, you know, and think of things as being very remotely separated and stuff. You know, or occasionally they picture them as very separated, but they know that there's a connection in, they can, when they see the fossil record, you know, and you got land life, and so they have to imagine some really bizarre, long isthmus, you know, connecting these very separated, you know, continents. It's like, no, they weren't that separated, okay? So it wasn't this, like, magical thread isthmus across great distances.
We're seeing a lot of things that show it all as one mass, you know, and it shows how the Africa separated from South Africa.
Yeah, yeah, you've seen that, right? But see, like we said, that's appropriate going back a little ways. Like, we'll eventually get there, and we... but we're a long ways back from that, where, you know, you didn't have those plates moving around back here. Yeah. We're you know, 150 million years away from that yet, basically. Okay. Okay. So they're just trying to remind you of that. So it's appropriate that it says continental drifts there. See? Okay.
As the land emerges from the last Silurian inundation, an important period in world development and life evolution comes to an end. It is the dawn of a new age on Earth. The naked and unattractive landscape of former times is becoming clothed with luxuriant verdure, and the first magnificent forests will soon appear.
Okay, so you know, we're definitely moving towards when we're going to have very, very heavy-duty plant life on the land. You know, we really haven't had that yet. You know, and you can see how that ties up with what they said before. I mean, it's been very much an ocean planet, with, you know, and continents, any dry land is a, you know, is an asterisk, right? We basically are still kind of in the mode where it was a global ocean, right? And, oh, yeah, I mean, occasionally there's some dry land. But we are moving towards where land is going to become more of an ongoing definitive phenomena. That makes sense. If the crust is slowly getting harder and harder, more and more rigid, like I said, we're moving slowly towards plates and plate tectonics. And that's all part of the same process. Is it something that you had?
Well, I'm just picturing that it's a wasteland.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. Unattractive. There's no
barren.
Yeah.
Barren and no beauty. And people think we're going to go live on Mars.
Yeah. Not only barren, but remember, you know, in a lot of areas, like we were saying, there isn't much elevation either. So you don't even have, like, you know, Grand Canyons, even if there isn't any plant life. Right. And a lot of it's just flatlands, you know, with really nothing to them.
Was accretion still going on? Were we still being bombarded by... meteors?
By now, that's, you know, down to a you know, relative minimum. I mean, yeah, occasionally, obviously, you still are having some impacts. You know, we can see, you know, the kind of impacts that, you know, you would still have. You know, we see signs of those big craters, right, in the Canadian Shield or something like that. But yeah, I mean, that's not, see, not only has, like they said, the volcanic activity quite died down, cataclysmic meteoric stuff, right? Local cataclysms, yeah, you know, 1 meter comes in, boom. But nothing of a planetary or even a really significantly regional scale anymore, right? Very sporadic now. Because remember, you've got a significant atmosphere, right? It's going to stop most of it.
The marine life of this age was very diverse due to the early species segregation. But later on, there was free commingling and association of all these different types. The brachiopods early reached their climax, being succeeded by the arthropods, and barnacles made their first appearance. But the greatest event of all was the sudden appearance of the fish family. This became the age of fishes, that period of the world's history characterized by the vertebrate type of animal.
Okay, so that's the biggie, of course, having vertebrates. Suddenly there were fishes. You know, that's one of the most significant suddenlies of all of them, you know, relative to something that's starting to be closer to us. Right? You can look at a fish, it's like, oh, I can see a lot of things about their skeletal structure that are, you know, foreshadowing me, you know, right? And if you don't know when suddenly there's fishes, flip to the end of the section. This is the Devonian. Okay? And that's Devon County. That's Devonshire. All right, so, you know, that's just immediately south of Wales there in that little tip, you know, of southwestern England. All right, so we're still in that same low basic locale, see, for these names. Yeah. All right, but the Devonian, that's when you know, all of a sudden you've got all kinds of beautiful fish fossils that you can find, right? And, I'm sure you guys have probably even seen those in a, you know, in a rock shop or something, right? You can get lots and lots of beautiful fossilized fish. Because suddenly there's fishes everywhere, and they're falling in the mud and getting fossilized. All right, so you see how, you know, they're mentioning, you know, we still have brachiopods today, but you have these peaks where they're, you know, these various species are kind of the leading edge. In truth, that's the pre-human, right, of that age. Right? And then pre-human passes to the next thing, and then pre-human passes to the next thing. It's all, you know, leading edges of pre-humanness until finally it is suddenly human. It's all the evolution of us. All of this is just the evolution of us. What it takes to make a will creature.
With a pod and a stomach.
Right. We all know that gastropod is alive and well in many humans.
Unfortunately.
We all know the WALL-E movie, right? You know. Yes, they were very much just stomachs. It went retrograde back to gastropods. Okay, so but we see we're getting more complicated. We got barnacles, right? They'll mention here in a little bit, you know, exactly how this works, how you get the fishes. Okay, let's keep going here.
270 million years ago, the continents were all above water. In millions upon millions of years, not so much land had been above water at one time. It was one of the greatest land emergence epochs in all world history.
Yeah, read the next one too.
5 million years later, the land areas of North and South America, Europe, Africa, Northern Asia, and Australia were briefly inundated. In North America, the submergence at one time or another being almost complete, and the resulting limestone layers run from 500 to 5,000 feet in thickness. These various Devonian seas extended first in one direction and then in another, so that the immense Arctic North American inland sea found an outlet to the Pacific Ocean through Northern California.
So just again, to picture that, you know, they give you that little paragraph about how it is one of the greatest land emergence epochs of all world history. It says, oh, we've got Havona, No, almost immediately it's all down under the water again. See, see how they're playing with you. They're playing with your spiritual consciousness. The way they're writing this, right? You wanting to, oh, it's going to be really beautiful now. We want to pour epoxy over that, right, and make that eternal, right? I mean, no. As soon as it's there, it's all gone. Just like so many of our material creations during our lives, right? that's just part of the process. All right, so that's the obvious truth that's flowing through those. Just a mere 5 billion years later, a lot of it's underwater again, and you've got 5,000 feet of limestone laid down again, right? All right. But you can again still see how, when they talk about, like that last little bit of the Arctic, sea, coming down, again, like this at the beginning, don't think of stuff really spread out. Think of it all kind of as, fairly closely, and it's, so you basically just have this stuff that's just moving about. It isn't way spread out over the whole globe, right? It's in a much tighter mode than geologists tend to visualize it when you see them, running back the clock. It's like you run back the clock and you get Pangaea, but then you go run the clock back further and it breaks up and then it comes together again and it breaks up and it comes together again. It's like, that none of that is valid, right? Because there wasn't plate tectonics back then.
May have been submerged in a couple
of years. Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, there was definitely, they can see, if it's a marine deposit or whatnot. But they're interpreting that as a result of plate tectonic variations, and it's not. Yeah. Okay.
260 million years ago, toward the end of this land depression epoch, North America was partially overspread by seas having simultaneous connections with the Pacific, Atlantic, Arctic, and Gulf waters. The deposits of these later stages of the first Devonian flood average about 1,000 feet in thickness. The coral reefs characterizing these times indicate that the inland seas were clear and shallow. Such coral deposits are exposed in the banks of the Ohio River near Louisville, Kentucky, and are about 100 feet thick, embracing more than 200 varieties. These coral formations extend through Canada and Northern Europe to the Arctic regions.
Just all those things that if you're not familiar with the geologic history of the Earth, you go, whoa, really? I had no idea there was, right? Okay, so there's that basic surprise element for the uninitiated. And again, little logical things they throw in, that you may, if you've been around oceans, you may be familiar enough with coral reefs and, how they work, and you know that they can't be in very deep water, right? You don't get enough light because there's a symbiotic relationship with the algae, right? So you got to have photosynthesis going on. So if you find a coral reef deposit, no matter how ancient it is, that was a shallow, relatively shallow, clear sea. Right? You can make those logical connections. And the geologists know that. They try to do that as best they can. But occasionally, like I was just saying a minute ago, right? They've over-extrapolated. You got to be careful about something might be rational, but it may not be logical, even though it's rational. You might have reasoned it, but it might not be correctly reasoned. There may be other ways to reason that out, your observations that you haven't thought of. And the revelators definitely will make a point of occasionally throwing in little hints along those lines to help the geologists. I think we've got basically everything there. Let's keep going here.
Following these submergences, many of the shorelines were considerably elevated so that the earlier deposits were covered by mud or shale. There is also a red sandstone stratum, which characterizes one of the Devonian sedimentations, and this red layer extends over much of the Earth's surface, being found in North and South America, Europe, Russia, China, Africa, and Australia. Such red deposits are suggestive of arid or semi-arid conditions, but the climate of this epoch was still mild and even.
Coincidentally, in the next paragraph, just what I was saying.
You read it.
Yes, not so coincidentally. But that's why I was just, you know, trying to give you that hint. I mean, you can, the revelators foreshadow all the time like this, and you can kind of start to pick up on that. Oh, I bet there's something about coming up here that's going to hint at. So if you look up how they think those red sandstones, you know, came to be red, how they came to have hematite in them like that, they have decided that it's because there was arid or semi-arid conditions. Yes, it is suggestive of that. That's one way you can get hematite. But it's not the way it happened here, is it? No. There weren't desert regions on the planet back then. Right? But the climate of this epoch was still mild and even. Okay. So they've made a false assumption, right? And they're basing all of their rationalization on the belief that that's what was going on there. You know, and it has to do with all kinds of assumptions they're making about the atmosphere and about the sun and about plate tectonics and yada, 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 yada. All this stuff is this vast, elaborate, it's all rational within itself, but it's not true, right? The revelators tell you one little thing like that, poke a hole in one spot, and the whole elaborate structure breaks. You got to go back and rethink the whole picture, right, that you'll read in a Wikipedia page.
Is the Morrison Formation part of this red stuff?
No, that's much later on. No, this is way farther back.
So they tell
We're in the Devonian here. What was that?
They just say it wasn't. They don't say why it was, right?
Right, they don't say why it was. You have to figure that out. They're just telling you it's not what you currently think, right? You know other ways you could get that, you know, think about those. Or maybe it's something you haven't thought of yet. Or, you know, that's what they can't give you that stuff you can figure out. The scientists need to figure it out. But they're helping you so that you don't get stuck in a belief that's false, like we're stuck right now. And like I said, it has huge consequences. Doesn't matter what you're doing. I mean, you know, that if at some point in the book they poke one little hole, you know, in something about, say, stellar interior theory, stellar energy generation, right, that has sweeping consequences. That doesn't just change how we don't just have to rethink our stellar interior theory. Because we have a whole elaborate rationalization scheme where, you know, we've dotted every I and crossed every T. It's all consistent, but it's all false. It blows up the whole picture, and you got to start all over again. Re-rationalize it, but now try to do it truthfully. There's endless numbers of false worldviews. There's only one true worldview. Which do you have? One of the infinite number of false ones? Or the one true one? It's like, well, how could I ever get the one true one? Well, because that's why there's revelation occasionally. Right?
Eventually, evolution. The revelation helps you get there.
Right. That's what, you know. And again, it's sweeping. Right? I mean, it touches upon things that are very near and dear to your heart, as they say. Right? The way you've always understood your relationship to God. You know, are you courageous enough to let the revelation blow that up so that you can replace it with a better understanding of your relationship to God? Right? You won't lose the truth. Right? That's kind of buried down in all the, you know, the erroneous construct that you have wrapped around that thread of truth. Right? They're trying to get you to blast off all that, you know, that debris that you've accumulated on that little thread of truth and build a true structure around that core. Okay, step forward again here. I better check. Did we get everything there? We did the red sandstone. Oh, you noticed covered by mud or shale, right? See, I mean, you know that's not supposed to say shale. You know, remember they told you what shale is. You know that that's supposed to say slate back there. And if there's any doubt. Okay.
Throughout all of this period, the land southeast of the Cincinnati Island remained well above water, but very much of Western Europe, including the British Isles, was submerged. In Wales, Germany, and other places in Europe, the Devonian rocks are 20,000 feet thick.
20,000 feet thick.
Where's the Cincinnati Island?
Yeah, where's the Cincinnati Island you're going? I've been all over there. I don't remember. Yeah, just a little reminder of how different the topography was, right, if you go back. But, you know, when you study all the geology, you know, wait a minute, I think this area was an island for a long time. And, you know, you get hints at that. You know, and if they toss that in the Revelation, if there's any doubt about that, there it is, definitively. It's been validated. Now you just maybe need to figure out exactly where the boundaries of that one-time island, you know, were. But I had to give you these little anchor points. Yeah, but it's fun to think about, you know, North America and all, you know, being so different, you know, like they said, having an outlet to the Pacific Ocean through Northern California, you know, all these different things that, you know, you can't even imagine right now, right?
That's what it seems. The Columbia River, something
right.
Up there.
Right. And just, you know, that's the challenge in trying to understand what they tell you about the first garden. You got to remember, you know, the geography was radically different back then than it is now. You can't look at a map today and, oh, I can see what they're talking about there in that paper about the Garden of Eden. I mean, things have completely changed from what they were back then, right? You got mountains where there weren't mountains and, you know, et cetera. You know, so you got to try to, you know, let go of the, you know, the geography of today and
even
40,000 years ago, right? Because it's a very geologically active region there, right? You got all kinds of plate boundary activity in that area. You know, talk about, you know, ask people who live there how many earthquakes they have on a regular basis, right? It's a very active region. Okay, yep, keep going here.
250 million years ago witnessed the appearance of the fish family, the vertebrates, one of the most important steps in all pre-human evolution.
Oh, look at that. What word did they just use there?
Pre-human.
Right? Not animal evolution. Right? In fact, it's animal evolution. But in truth, it's pre-human evolution. Right? And it is, right, one of the most important steps. Right? Like I was saying up front.
Yeah. That's why you'd call it not just scorpion, true scorpion.
Right, right.
It's a land dwelling.
Right. See, you know, that stuff that's just scaffolding, you're eventually getting to something that's an element of the whole, you know, and is a true element in that whole, mm-hmm. Right? Like true science and true religion are elements in a whole. Right? If you don't have the whole first, you can't have true science or true religion. Those are parts. And it's impossible for those parts to be true unless you're coming at them from the top down in the context of the whole. True philosophy. Right, true scorpions, true science, true religion, right? Okay, yes, pre-human evolution. Yep.
The arthropods, or crustaceans, were the ancestors of the first vertebrates, the forerunners of the fish family, were two modified arthropod ancestors. One had a long body connecting a head and a tail, while the other was a backboneless, jawless pre-fish. But these preliminary types were quickly destroyed when the fishes, the first vertebrates of the animal world, made their sudden appearance from the north.
So you've got some parallel tracks happening, you know, and there's some suddenlies, but they don't lead to suddenly fishes. They fall short, right? Again, not surprising because we're in a decimal world, so there's all kinds of odd parallels to the main track, right? And when you do suddenly get true fishes, those other ones quickly get eaten and disappear.
Interesting that they say from the north.
Yeah, see, and even little things like that. You just notice how they throw that in, so that you can get some sense about which of these kind of quasi isolated regions this stuff is coming from, right? And and you could try, and I can see in the fossil record, the backboneless, jawless prefish, they were off in another area and weren't in it, in that north region. Right? So they represent kind of a, because remember, you started with the three implantations, and how they mentioned, you've got a little bit of separation between what suddenly has happened in those three basic pockets of life. Okay.
Juxtaposition of these two very different types of creatures.
So I was just about to explain that, the beginning there. Like I said, when we finally got to the genuine suddenly, so 250 million years ago, suddenly there's fishes. Okay, and you've got some kind of a crustacean. They say, the general arthropods, right, the jointed leg creatures, specifically crustaceans. So some kind of crustacean, some certain crustaceans, they don't specify, some certain crustacean laid some eggs. Fish hatched out of those eggs, not that crustacean, right? Suddenly, there were fishes, right? You have, and there's no way, this is an example where paleontologists, completely can't imagine something like this. I mean, they're trying to lay all the different species out of the alive and extinct, and try to get the tiniest little jumps they can and somehow put them in some gradually sequence, and there's not even remotely a way they can think of some gradually going from crustaceans to fishes, no matter what kind of a crustacean they imagine. And so they absolutely would reject, this. It's like, that's the whole point. There is no in-between, right? There are no missing links, right? Literally, some crustacean laid eggs, and fish hatched out of those eggs.
I think it was one
generation. I have no idea how, how parallel this happens with these suddenlies. Mm-hmm. I mean, with humans, right? I mean, it was just a pair. Way back here, a crustacean lays lots of eggs.
Yeah.
Right? Even if it's just, one pair of crustaceans leading to it and not many, I don't know. But, yeah.
Well, at first I thought these two different creatures got together and produced something. That doesn't make sense. Are they describing a step-by-step process with these two different?
Well, what do you mean two different?
Well,
those other two. Those are just parallel things. Those are parallel things that didn't lead to fish. They're giving that for the paleontologists to think, well, maybe those were an in-between thing, and those led to fish. No, those came out of the arthropods in different ways and didn't lead to true fish. Those were dead ends. Yeah. The parallel.
Forerunners,
right?
No, ancestors.
The forerunners, right?
Two modified ancestors, right?
But again, you got it. You're thinking in linear fashion. You can't think in linear fashion. You got to think in parallel fashion. It's a purposed system. If you had killed off those fish that came up somewhere else, fish would have come up again.
Yeah.
There's many, many different ways that suddenly you can have fishes, right? And they're just pointing out a couple of those parallels, right? Their ancestors are forerunners in, think of a, let's just think of it two-dimensionally. Okay. Instead of a line going forward.
Ancestors, not these right. Dead-end creatures.
Right.
Okay. Do you see? I mean, think in the general terms of, they weren't in fact ancestors, but in truth, they're ancestors. Right? It's a revelation of truth. Right? Yeah. And the literalness of that is you have all of these parallel tracks. Right.
Okay.
And
fishes and there was lunch.
Yeah. See, it's not literally the pre-fish that then, you know, one day that pre-fish, you know, lays eggs and then true fish come out of it. Not in that simple. See, that's the way the current paleontologists think. And that's not true. It's not the way it works.
Why from the north?
Well, yeah, I mean, who knows, right? I can't answer the why from the north, but...
Because it happened on the South Pole, so everything's
from the north. But I can guarantee you that the more you study the fossil record, the fact that they gave you that little clue will help you to sort it out. Okay. Now, most likely, these predator true fish are the placoderms, right? Those plate skin, right? You know, those early fish that had bony front, you know, parts to them, you know, and remember you've probably seen in a museum gigantic placoderms, right? You got the fossilized, you know, front part of them, all those plates. They've got big maws if you've ever seen them in a museum. Like, yeah, those would have eaten all that other stuff in short order, yeah. Yeah. Again, just, you know, the challenge is to think about evolution as not a linearly, you know, purposed phenomenon even, but as, you know, a ubiquitously purposed phenomenon. That's a story that gets more and more common the more we read forward in these papers. Right? More and more you see, you know, a certain kind of enduring species trying to come into existence, and it tries it here, then that doesn't go anywhere, so it tries it over here, you know, a little later, and that doesn't go anywhere. You know, and eventually when you get to almost getting up to Anna and Infanta, you have 7,000 parallel lines, all of which could have had a suddenly that gave you a human, but only one of which did, right? And so close that, you know, we all know those Andonites backmated with a whole bunch of those, you know, near human lines, right? So it's this very intense parallel phenomenon. Closer it gets to the goal of will creatures, the more intensely parallel it becomes.
Well, this is suddenly of all suddenlies here.
Yeah, right. This is a huge suddenly, right? To go from invertebrate to vertebrate in one step. Suddenly, there's fishes. If you need any, you know, I mean, if you literally watched that happen, right? You know, you had your pet crustaceans, and one day they lay eggs, and then fish hatch out of them, right? That would make you believe that evolution is purposed, right?
And our kids,
no longer would you doubt.
Yeah. Kids eating us.
Right. Right. It would just strike you as utterly magical. Right. But again, it's not. It's a coalescence of the wholeness. Right. All of that potential for fishes is there, and it just coalesces, right, in this point of purpose, in that phase change, right, from crustacean to fish. Right. You don't have something in between. You know, liquid water and water vapor, and it goes from one to the next in one step. Okay.
Many of the largest true fish belong to this age, some of the teeth-bearing varieties being 25 to 30 feet long. The present-day sharks are the survivors of these ancient fishes. The lung and armored fishes reached their evolutionary apex, and before this epoch had ended, fishes had adapted to both fresh and salt waters.
It's easy. You see the armored fishes there. But of course, you know, we lungfishes, you know, do peter forward all the way to today. But they're not the dominant fact. just a little aside here. You know how in the library, on the Perfecting Horizons website, the Perfecting Horizons Library, how I have a few, I haven't done it in a long time, but there's a few Q&As that I've posted in there over the years. There's a Q&A in there called, I believe it's called The Science in the Urantia Book. And I have a some summaries of some of these general issues about science that I've been bringing up here, but I also bring it to a specific point. It's relative to a question that I got asked about this whole issue of the evolution of fish relative to crustaceans and arthropods in general. So if you're interested in, you know, as an example of me kind of burrowing into the science a little bit more precisely on some of these issues relative to current thinking, you can look at that little Q&A there. Okay, let's keep going. Oh, wait, we forgot to mention. Yeah, see some of those guys 25 to 30 feet long? Right. Obviously, you know, the lesser species are not going to make it very long. They're giant eating machines. Let's see. Did I get everything else there? Again, notice how quickly stuff happens, right? Before this epoch, by that they mean not literally geologic epochs, but, you know, our little steps here of 10 million years, right? See, in a very relatively short time, even relative to the Devonian, I mean, the horizontal evolution is just, and they adapt to every nook and cranny, right, in very rapid order. So, as rapid as they can go upward to fish, they can go horizontally pretty rapidly too in relative terms. It's not a suddenly, right? But in relative to hundreds of millions of years, boom, right there, you've got freshwater fish and saltwater fish and everything you can imagine. Okay.
Veritable bone beds of fish teeth and skeletons may be found in the deposits laid down toward the close of this period. And rich fossil beds are situated along the coast of California, since many sheltered bays of the Pacific Ocean extended into the land of that region.
Sheltered bays, but not, remember, you can't see it, you just can't see miss such a suggestion, right? I mean, they do everything but put an arrow pointing that. Remember the sheltered bay analogy? Now you've been pushed out of the sheltered bays. And then in the midst of reminding you of that, veritable bone beds of fish teeth and skeletons. Whoa. Right? Don't be surprised if when we're pushed out of the sheltered bays, in terms of civilizational evolution, you could have some very unsettled times where there's lots of death and reorganization and whatnot, right? Remember they tell you it's not going to settle down for 1,000 years. We live in we've been pushed out of the sheltered bays, and there's going to be a very tumultuous time, right? Where you will be quite convinced by the bone piles that there can't be a god. This is definitely not Havona. And if there was a god, this would be like Havona. And there wouldn't be bone piles. Just reminding you of that evolutionary process can be very difficult. Sometimes pain and suffering is more poignant than other times.
Sounds rugged.
Yeah, rugged. Truth is rugged, right? And that they're just reminding you of that between the lines with statements like that. Okay.
The Earth was being rapidly overrun by the new orders of land vegetation. Heretofore, few plants grew on land except about the water's edge. Now, and suddenly, the prolific fern family appeared and quickly spread over the face of the rapidly rising land in all parts of the world. Tree types 2 feet thick and 40 feet high soon developed. Later on, leaves evolved, but these early varieties had only rudimentary foliage.
They didn't have leaves originally, initially.
There were many smaller plants, but their fossils are not found, since they were usually destroyed by the still earlier appearing bacteria.
Coincidentally, when they finally get, trees falling in the forest, and you don't want trees piling up endlessly, that's a mess. You need bacteria to foster the decay of those. Coincidentally, before you needed those bacteria, the bacteria are already in place. See how they're hinting again? Now, of course, with bacteria, right, those didn't evolve into place. Those were built by the primary associators.
When? Right?
When? Well, we don't know when.
It wasn't in the prokaryotic?
Right, they're prokaryotes. Right? I mean, you know, who knows? See, they just leave that dangling. I mean, you wouldn't have, before you had a lot of organic matter that you needed to decay, say they probably didn't build them way back, 900 million years ago, and they're making the cyanobacteria and stuff. At some point, the life carriers instructed them to build those, and the life carriers are there, so they get, the first phase of life animation. They get the living vitality, and off they go. But see, the key is just again reminding you what you need is in place before you need it. Yeah. Even if there's very overtly beings involved in the process like this, right? They have a plan and they're executing a plan. The whole thing is purposed. They know when they're going to do this step, when they're going to do that step. And again, remember, until you get will creatures, the life carriers can be very directly involved in inserting themselves into the evolutionary process. Right? They can't design new life, right? But they can very definitively tweak it and do things with it and whatnot, foster its migration this way instead of that way and all those sorts of things. Right? Yep.
Sure, I heard you correctly. You're suggesting that this type of bacteria didn't come from the early bacteria of pre-life.
And prokaryotes don't evolve.
No, they don't evolve. Yeah. But you're saying that there's a new injection of new bacteria as type.
Right, that would be, what your first assumption is that sometime, who knows when, once you finally had, plant life that you needed to decay like this, right? These were in place. I don't know when. The more you studied such things, the more you could, to make some deductions about that. But before you get into all those specific facts, they're just trying to give you that basic truth that you can recognize yet again, right? It isn't like, oh my goodness, I didn't think of that. That we got to make some bacteria. We got these tree trunks piling up. No,
it's a reaction.
Nothing is a reaction. Shells aren't a reaction to predators, right? It's a purposed system, right? That's what they're trying to keep impressing upon you. Notice one of the biggies. It's not just animals that have suddenlies. Plant life has suddenlies too. Suddenly there's ferns, right? So you got whatever kind of life, and there's this huge jump, and suddenly you have, things that can be, that can go, can be, quickly become 40-foot high trees, right? And you had nothing remotely like that before, right? You had lots and lots of time where something could have gone tree-like, but didn't. But suddenly you have something in very short order, boom, produces gigantic forms. Okay, so, suddenly we'll have flowering plants, and stuff, when we get down the road a ways. Okay.
As the land rose, North America became connected with Europe by land bridges extending to Greenland. And today, Greenland holds the remains of these early land plants beneath its mantle of ice.
Just in case you were wondering. All right. Yes, it was very tropic up there, remember.
Okay. 240 million years ago, the land over parts of both Europe and North and South America began to sink. This subsidence marked the appearance of the last and least extensive of the Devonian floods. The Arctic seas again moved southward over much of North America. The Atlantic inundated a large part of Europe and Western Asia, while the Southern Pacific covered most of India. This inundation was slow in appearing and equally slow in retreating. The Catskill Mountains along the west bank of the Hudson River are one of the largest geologic monuments of this epoch to be found on the surface of North America.
The basic, you know, issue of just how variable it is still. They have to keep reminding you of that, so that you don't, like I have said several times, you don't start thinking of, you know, that we're in a mode that is like today that you can extrapolate backwards, okay? And, you know, not to mention giving you just little things, you know, it's like, think about when you're reading the life and teachings of Jesus and they give you some little things like, ooh, I bet I could go, you know, to Israel and actually find that spot, you know? You know, they're doing a similar thing here, you know, for those who don't already know the geology, you know, and you know, like I said, trying to get you to feel an organic connection with the ground that you walk upon, right? If you've never looked down at the ground under your feet and never looked up at the stars in the night sky, they're trying to encourage that, you know.
If you're not doing that, you're on your cell phone.
Right. Get you to think, and, you know. It's like, you know, so if you're in the Catskills, you know, go, oh, cool, that's right. Oh, you know, and you can have some sense of where you are in relationship to your evolutionary past. And
so do you notice how a lot of this has to do with, like, North America and Europe, and not a lot about Asia, and not a lot about South America.
Remember, they remind you to do that. You know, remember, a lot of Asia is kind of just sitting there, and it's not going, you know, under and so, you know, it's these other areas that are more low lying, and they're constantly, you know, having all this variability. So that, you know, a lot of that is just because of the geology. I mean, if you get a historical geology text, it's the same way, right? I mean, they're talking about North America all the time and whatnot, you know, in the same way, because that's just where all the action is. And, okay, I think we got everything, did we? Yeah, keep going.
230 million years ago, the seas were continuing their retreat. Much of North America was above water, and great volcanic activity occurred in the St. Lawrence region. Mount Royal in Montreal is the eroded neck of one of these volcanoes. The deposits of this entire epoch are well shown in the Appalachian Mountains of North America, where the Susquehanna River has cut a valley exposing these successive layers, which attained a thickness of over 13,000 feet.
Again, kind of gets the same spirit as the last one. You know, I mean, if nothing else, the 13,000 feet, you know, just hits you again like a sledgehammer. It's like, wow, I just never thought about things being that thick. And boy, it's amazing that Montreal is in Montreal. Yes, but again, mentioning, you know, when they mention that volcanic activity, right? Again, that's a reminder. Oh yeah, I'm going to have some stuff I can date, right? And so all that synchronizes with you understanding how, you know, how we have tried to, you know, use radiometric dating to get dates for this stuff, but the relatives aren't limited to that. Doesn't matter if there's any volcanic stuff, any igneous rocks. Right? They're just telling you that, you know, literally this silt, right, filtered down to the bottom of the ocean floor at this date, right? I mean, we have no idea, right? You know, but they have the actual story, and they can just look up the date. They can give you, you know, what day, you know, that millimeter of silt was laid down, if they wanted to. It's all in the records. Like I said, it's very difficult to be precise about that ratio of radiometric date to actual date. Not only because they don't give you many significant digits in the Rancho book, but I mean, you know, we are stretching, trying to pin down dates on this stuff, because, you know, it's not just a big pile of igneous rock and you can date it precisely at every single level. It's not like that. Okay. The one thing I wanted to mention there, Mount Royal. Even though you don't have mountain ranges, obviously, you'll have volcanic mountains, right? or, you know, a region that might be several volcanoes. And so, you know, you can have mountains, you know, like Mount Fuji, you know, way back, you know, in these days. You know, you just don't have the Rocky Mountains,
yeah.
Right? You don't have things like that. You don't have tectonic mountain ranges, okay? All right.
The elevation of the continents proceeded, and the atmosphere was becoming enriched with oxygen. The earth was overspread by vast forests of ferns 100 feet high and by the peculiar trees of those days, silent forests. Not a sound was heard, not even the rustle of a leaf, for such trees had no leaves.
Yeah, maybe before you read that last one, just, you know, see, to dwell on that. You have to think about that, you know, that for ages and ages you didn't have leaves. You know, there was sudden, we haven't gotten to suddenly there was leaves yet. And so you have these very fluffy things that don't really rustle.
Was stuff. There wind?
Yeah, there's wind, but you wouldn't have the kind of rustling that we think of today. So think of vast, silent forests, you know, with no animals.
Right.
You know, not a single animal, you know, not even a little, you know, insect, you know, running around on the ground. Nothing, not a single animal, you know, and the entire continent covered with these silent, 100-foot-high forests.
You're going from 40 feet to 100 feet.
Right, yeah, you see, it didn't take them long to even get even bigger, right? Mm-hmm. Right, so just how fascinating would it be to go to a planet in that stage, right, and just walk through a forest like that?
No bugs.
No bugs, right? You know,
no bug bears.
Fascinating place it would be, you know? All of these exotic curlicue, you know, foliage stuff, you know, it'd be very, very alien landscape. Very, you know, just think of how peaceful it would be. You know, how you could reflect in a place like that. You know, you don't have to be looking around, you know, wondering if some carnivore is coming up on you, or, you know, not a single mosquito anywhere. It is Havona.
All right, get the epoxy out. We're ready to go. Right.
So. Whenever I see a bug or something around my window, and I always try to capture things and let them out. I don't kill bugs if I can help it. And I always think, if we found you on Mars, you'd be a miracle.
Right. Right. But you see why I wanted you to stop and not read. I wanted to kind of play this out a little bit. See how we, you know, they are reminding you that you definitely had Gardens of Eden sort of states, you know. There were times that are just like, you know, beyond your imagination of an idyllic garden domain, right? As far as the eye can see in every direction, you know. But, you know, then it turns into coal beds, right? All this beautiful greenage, you know, is going to get crushed into coal beds, you know, in the next period. Okay, but anyway, to wrap it up here.
And thus drew to a close one of the longest periods of marine life evolution, the Age of Fishes. This period of the world's history lasted almost 50 million years. It has become known to your researchers as the Devonian.
There we have it, yes, the Devonian. And as I was hinting, we are building up, you know, some of the great sequestration of carbon here now. I mean, you've got serious plant life now that's sequestering carbon, which coincidentally humans will need one day. That's where we're going next. And you can see by the title, not only do we have the Carboniferous, you know, as the next period, but we're going to get the land creatures finally. Soon as you really have the significant plant life, so that you can definitively get the atmosphere into the proper ratio of oxygen, you know, to carbon dioxide.
Plus, the animals have to have something to eat.
Right, and they've got to have something to eat. Right, yeah. Coincidentally, they have something to eat before they need to have something to eat, and all of that. Just appreciate how that, you know, that fits together. And as I was just hinting, you know, that's one of the big things we'll talk about next time is they already told you it was, you know, even from our perspective, you can think of a fish as pre-human, like you can't think of a, you know, a brachiopod as pre-human. You know, humans are very definitively coming into the story here next, right? The needs of humans are being very definitively prepared for, right, in the process coming up next. All right. Anyone ready? Nothing that we need to... Okay. Well, let's take a moment here, everyone.